From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, in town halls around the country, elected officials found themselves shouted down by mobs of conservative protesters infuriated by Democratic plans for major government intervention in the healthcare system. The episodes were noisy, disruptive, and in at least one case in Tampa, Florida, a bit violent. What the protests weren't was spontaneous. They'd all been cooked up by a right-wing political consultancy called FreedomWorks, the fact of which shocked the media left. This is an ad put out by the Democratic National Committee.
This mob activity is straight from the playbook of high-level Republican political operatives.
And here's MSNBC's Keith Olbermann and Rachel Maddow.
Good evening from New York. A so-called grassroots movement as fake as the purportedly spontaneous Tea Party protests that broke out on Tax Day. Our fifth story on the countdown, the astroturfing of health care reform in a desperate bid to defeat it.
The more time you spend looking into this seemingly organic outrage at these town hall meetings, the more clear it is that this isn't organic at all. This is orchestrated outrage. There is a script for this stuff. Corporate lobbyists are organizing far-right hooligan tactics to disrupt civic meetings about health care reform. This is the organized use of intimidation as a political tool in the United States.
They're not wrong. FreedomWorks absolutely acknowledges mobilizing and choreographing citizens to noisily express their disgust. And whether it's a genuine grassroots movement or the kind of phony grassroots movement called astroturfing may be besides the point, just as it was besides the point when the tactics were invented by the political left. Here's what FreedomWorks spokesman Adam Brandon told us back in April after its tea parties around the country unspontaneously protested the federal stimulus package.
When we get our jobs in our organization, the first thing you do is you sit down with some of Saul Alinsky's books, Rules for Radicals. And we read that book and we study that book. And everything that we've been trying to do here comes straight out of those pages.
Take that, Rachel Maddow. So who is this Saul Alinsky? We asked New Yorker staffer Ryan Lizza, who has written about the Rules for Radicals and the history of, hey, Sarah Palin, check this out, community organizing.
Alinsky's basic insight was, what would happen if you used the sort of hard-headed, very realistic negotiating tactics that labor uses when they negotiate with management? What if you took those techniques and adapted them to the relationship between your average citizen and public officials?
So when people sneer about those leftist agitators,
yeah,
we can thank Saul Alinsky because he was the one who got the idea to start agitating them.
That's exactly right. And agitating is exactly the phrase that they used. You had to get people a little angry about the state of affairs in their lives before they would actually take action. But the ideas behind community organizing are the opposite of idealistic. There's a famous story. Whenever Alinsky would have a new student coming to organize, he would ask them, why do you want to be an organizer? And they would always say, well, I want to help others. You know, I want to devote my life to doing good. And he would scream back at them, no, you want to organize for power. Obama's organizing buddies shared with me a manual that was very similar to the one that Obama used to train as an organizer. And in it, it said, we are not virtuous by not wanting power. We are really cowards for not wanting power because power is good and powerlessness is evil. This is the first concept you learn as a community organizer and the first concept that Obama learned when he got to Chicago and learned to be a community organizer.
So it's not the kumbaya hand-holding kind of activity that people seem to associate with community organizing. You made a reference to the manuals. In fact, Alinsky codified such manuals into a book called Rules for Radicals.
Yeah.
Tell me about that book.
Alinsky was very critical of people on the left who wouldn't go as far as he would in terms of means if he believed it justified the end. He would call those people partners of the haves rather than the have-nots who he was trying to defend.
So he's very explicitly Machiavellian.
Absolutely. And this gets into his methods for holding public officials accountable. The famous community organizing method for holding public officials accountable is called the accountability session. This is probably the most famous thing associated with Alinsky now. he would go into a public meeting with an official and would not think twice about humiliating them or staging a very loud, angry protest. He had no empathy for the public official. The idea was to gain some attention for your cause. So he did, you know, all kinds of silly, confrontational events with public officials.
Sometimes just genuinely obnoxious.
Yeah, one of the probably the most famous one, this was a threat. I don't think it was ever actually carried out. But there was a race issue at Kodak in upstate New York. And Alinsky's idea was to hold a fart-in at the local opera house. In other words, he would have his protesters basically eat lots of gassy foods and then storm the opera house while presumably the executives from Kodak were there and then sort of, do their business.
So now we're in this topsy-turvy political world. The power has shifted dramatically from right to left. And all of a sudden, the political right has embraced Saul Alinsky using his book as a playbook for their activities. Does this surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me at all. You know, the truth is Alinsky, he's always mentioned as a man of the left, and he certainly was. But his legacy is not really ideological, it's methodological. And Rules for Radicals is certainly a book that can be applied to any ideological group.
Much has been made of whether these shouting down sessions at town halls around the country are real grassroots agitation or whether they're engineered astroturf kind of episodes. Fundamentally, does it matter?
You know, I don't think it does. And I think if you scratch the surface of most movements in America today, whether of the left or the right, money is coming from somewhere to fund them. And I think a lot of these tactics, a lot of the astroturfing is just sort of the way it is now. And part of creating a movement is creating the appearance of a movement. And I think that Alinsky would recognize some of these sessions as similar to what he was advising the people who eventually trained Barack Obama as a community organizer.
So what do you think so far? Is it working?
One of the things that Alinsky taught is that you have to have some objective at the end of the day, and that protesting for protest's sake is not really an effective way to organize. And so far, I haven't seen what the goal and objective is of the people that are shouting and disrupting these meetings. So far, I think it's actually been counterproductive. It's actually enabled the Democrats to make these folks look unreasonable. One of the things that's really changed since Alinsky is the media environment, right? And when you were Saul Alinsky working in Chicago and you were going and embarrassing a public official in front of his voters, you weren't necessarily on the 5 o'clock news afterwards, and you didn't necessarily have an opposition using your embarrassing tactics against you to discredit you and make you seem wholly unreasonable. So we don't know right now. It could all backfire on these guys and make them look crazy, or it could be the beginning of a precipitous decline in support for Obama.
Ryan, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan Lizza is the Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. Adam Brandon is the Vice President of Communications at FreedomWorks, and he joins us again. Adam, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks very much. I appreciate being here.
Last time we spoke, you said everybody was reading Saul Alinsky. Is that still your playbook?
Well, one of the main tenets of Saul Alinsky is it's how people without money influence politics, and that's kind of where we're at right now. We've got plenty of people. We just don't have huge resources to dump into supporting our issues.
So is your goal at any given town hall event to influence the congressperson who is being shouted down, or to get on YouTube with the episode, or just what?
There has been some rumors that we are actually advocating people getting into verbal fights and disrupting these town halls, and we have no part of any of that. But we are looking for people to be the first ones to the microphones to ask the difficult questions to start stirring up some debate. But these videos that you're seeing coming out of these town halls, you know, they're definitely agitated, they're definitely intense, but this is nothing compared to a high school football game.
A lot has been said about astroturfing as opposed to genuine grassroots movements.
Mm-hmm.
Are you astroturfing in the sense of deploying people to these meetings to create a confrontation, or do you consider this to be organic and genuine?
I mean, if this is astroturfing, everything that MoveOn.org is doing is astroturfing. The Boston Tea Party back in, you know, the 1770s would be astroturfing. We're doing basic organizing, and that is just trying to get people together, especially connecting them online, getting them materials such as talking points, and telling them where and when they show up to town halls. A lot of these people have never done anything like this. I guess astroturfing I would consider is if someone was actually paying people to show up to pretend to be passionate on an issue. We haven't paid anyone, and these people are plenty passionate on their issues.
Okay, so in a perfect world for FreedomWorks, word of these town hall episodes get around via YouTube and cable news and so forth, and all across the country, people see this and go, I'm going to go to my congressman's town hall meeting and give him a piece of my mind. That's the perfect world.
Correct.
Hell for you would be people to see all of this same stuff and go, what a bunch of jerks. You know, they want us to take them seriously. They're shrill. They're rude. They're agitators, the kind we hate when they're on the left. We don't want to see them on the right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with that. That's why we're telling people to be respectful. But you definitely have to have an edge in today's world. One of my criticisms sometimes of the Tea Party movements is, you know, times they've gotten too rah-rah with too much patriotic flag wearing when we're generally upset and we have grievances. So I have no problem with some anger entering into some of this, some of this anger, some of this passion.
So on balance, so far, would you say this has created backlash or, I don't know, front lash?
I tell you, the best thing that's happened to us is that a lot of left-wing bloggers have been putting stuff up, making us look like we're the 500-foot monster just tramping down all across America. And as soon as they do that, we see our web traffic go up and we see our signups go up even higher.
Well, Adam, once again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Adam Brandon is the Vice President for Communications at FreedomWorks. Coming up, we speak to a soldier turned journalist turned soldier who's caught in a war of conflicting loyalties. This is On the Media from NPR.
Hi, Jesse Thorne here, host and producer of The Sound of Young America. Our show's been such a successful podcast that some people don't know that it's also a nationally syndicated public radio program. With that in mind, I make sure to approach my interviews with the dispassionate objectivity that's expected of all good public radio journalism. Like when I spoke with the writers of The Late Show with David Letterman.
I've been thinking a lot lately, probably too much, about a bit called How Many Spider-Mans Fit in a Jamba Juice.
Right. We really don't have time to deal with what that reflects in you, that you've been thinking about that a lot.
Check out The Sound of Young America and a whole bunch of other podcasts at MaximumFun.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Every once in a while, we come across a story that is, simply put, a reminder of the powerful role the press can play in a community. In July, the Gazette of Colorado Springs published a two-part series titled Casualties of War, which chronicled the heavy toll the Iraq War had taken on a group of soldiers posted at Fort Carson, Colorado. The 4th Infantry Division's 4th Brigade Combat Team saw brutal fighting first in the Sunni Triangle in 2004 and then in downtown Baghdad in 2006. Many who fought in the unit suffered deep psychological wounds as a result of the combat, wounds they carried home to Colorado. Since being discharged, at least 10 of the brigade's infantry have been arrested for murder, attempted murder, or manslaughter. When reporter Dave Phillips began this story, he thought it would be a piece about the soldiers' psychological struggles upon their return. But while reporting that story, through interviews with the soldiers incarcerated for their crimes over here, he uncovered war crimes that had been committed over there in Iraq. The details of the piece are staggering, gruesome, and heartbreaking. We wondered how Phillips got on the story in the first place, because the military most definitely wasn't on his beat.
My beat at the paper regularly is outdoor recreation, which means that I'm the guy who gets to write about how great Colorado skiing is and mountain biking. But with all papers contracting like they are, we are all filling in more and more beats. I think any reporter will tell you that. So I'd been doing a lot of feature writing over the last few years, and this was just something that seemed so pivotal to our community The Department of Defense is the largest employer in Colorado Springs, and its employees essentially were coming back and committing heinous violent crimes as a result of their work experience. And so that was just central both to those of us who are serving in the military and people who lived here in town.
Okay, so the snowmobiling reporter goes to the editor and says, I want to do 15,000 words on ex-soldier felons. After he or she stopped laughing, what happened next?
Well, Bob, you never tell your editor how long you think the story is going to be. And, you know, I think honestly this was a lot like a home improvement project where you think it's going to be a lot easier than it is. And then you tear off the roof and you see what's really under there. We started out in March of 2009 with just a few prison interviews. Those prison interviews led to some pretty shocking stories of what would widely be considered war crimes and just shocking treatment of men who had served their country and really got very little in return.
Tell me about dealing with the military during the course of your reporting. Were the public affairs officials and the top brass at Fort Carson available to you? Did they stonewall you? What was their participation?
From day one, they were completely unhelpful. Or I should say that some of them were completely unhelpful. In an organization that big, you have a lot of factions. Fort Carson has been very forward-looking and open-minded about caring for its soldiers and trying to change what's not working. However, the commanders of this brigade, and particularly some of the battalions in it, were outright hostile. They refused to give me even basic information, such as how many Humvees the units had. They wouldn't provide any high-level leaders to answer some of the pretty serious charges that I had because they said they were busy. I said, well, okay, since they're busy, give me lower leaders. They said, they're busy too. I was like, give me soldiers who were there. They said, they're all busy. Everybody's busy. We just had to really back up our story by finding enough soldiers who were out who could say, yeah, that's what happened.
You earlier mentioned the war crimes that your reporting uncovered. Tell me if I'm oversimplifying here, but what you discovered in your research and in your discussions with these young men was that the Army had very effectively created killing machines. They killed when they came back to civilian life, but they killed in an undisciplined and possibly illegal way when they were stationed in Iraq. Can you give me some examples?
Well, I don't want to give the impression that the Army trained these guys to do this because I don't think they did. But they trained them to engage in a certain kind of war, and it's not the war that they found when they got there. What you have is a number of very young men, 18, 19, 20 years old. They're in a situation where they're told to fight an enemy that they can't see. It's an insurgency with no uniforms, and something like 80% of the casualties from this unit came from improvised explosive devices. So they were getting blown up by a faceless enemy, and they started looking at the entire population there, civilian population, as the enemy. And I think a lot of times in frustration, they would act out. One soldier told me that if they got hit by an IED, they would just point their guns and their grenade launchers in every direction and shoot anyone that was there.
Within the bounds of listenership sensitivity, can you give me some more examples?
Well, soldiers told me they were so frustrated and mad by the end of their 2004 tour in Ramadi that they would run out over cars that didn't get out of the way in their essentially small tanks, a vehicle called a Bradley. Soldiers told me that they would shoot people driving by the base, sometimes without reason, not really knowing if they were killed or not, and that you didn't have to fear retribution unless they could be absolutely sure that you did it with no cause, which was almost impossible. And then there were also guys who just essentially went nuts while they were on patrol. I talked to one young man, Kenneth Eastridge, who was sitting in the turret on top of a Humvee guarding a street. And he had a 240 machine gun, which I believe shoots about 600 bullets a minute. And he just started shooting. And his fellow soldiers ordered him to cease fire over the radio, and he just kept shooting and shooting. And I asked him at the end, how many people do you think you killed? And he told me, not that many, maybe a dozen.
You mentioned an overwhelming response to your piece. I'm particularly interested in the official response from the Fort Carson and from the Pentagon. Have they acknowledged the conclusions of your reporting? And if so, how so?
Fort Carson has acknowledged my reporting somewhat in that they have a number of programs that they've set up to help soldiers to improve mental health care on their return. They've not spoken directly to me since the story came out. However, our senator from Colorado, Mark Udall, and other congressmen that are on the Armed Services Committee are holding a hearing because of the story. So I imagine that Fort Carson and hopefully the 4th Infantry Division commanders will have to answer some questions for them.
What about military investigations into the crimes that these men reported committing on duty in Iraq?
Only one of the soldiers I talked to told the military in the past about war crimes he had witnessed. The military told me when I asked that they had thoroughly investigated it by talking to a number of soldiers in his unit, and those soldiers had all said that nothing like that had happened. I don't know if they also interviewed Iraqis. They didn't tell me that they did, but obviously if they did not, there's a big hole in those kinds of investigations. I asked to see all records from the unit of anyone who was punished for doing things that I heard about, such as using electrical stun guns, using illegal ammunition, things like that. And they told me that they routinely destroy all disciplinary records. So whatever trail there was is quickly disappearing.
Colorado Springs is a conservative community. It has a huge military population. Has there been any kind of defensiveness in the response? Have you been attacked, threatened, dismissed?
Without exaggerating, I've gotten one negative comment in my email box that simply said, "You suck." But I also have a number of ones. I got one this morning from a Special Forces captain who said that he appreciated such an in-depth and unbiased look at what was going on. I think that there's sort of a sigh of relief that some of this stuff that hadn't been said is now being talked about.
Well, Dave, congratulations again. Spectacular piece of work, and thank you for joining us.
Hey, thanks for reading the whole thing.
I can't quite say it was a pleasure, but it was remarkable. Dave Phillips is a reporter for the Gazette of Colorado Springs. As he discovered, the military and the media have at best a strained relationship. The media resent the military's penchant for secrecy, while the military accuses the media of bias against it. But very few people actually know what it's like to be on both sides of that fight. Matt Mabe is one of those very few. Mabe had planned a lifelong career in the military before deciding to leave to become a reporter. From his unique vantage point with a foot in each camp, he found that both sides have grounds for mistrusting one another. One of the tragic consequences, Mabe says, is that the full story of what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan is not being told. He wrote about this and about his personal struggle with leaving the military. The piece appeared in the Columbia Journalism Review right before he was recalled to duty this summer. He joins us from Afghanistan to talk about his journey from soldier to reporter and back again. He says it was 2006 on his second tour of duty in Iraq when Mabe decided that he wanted to help tell the story of what was really going on over there.
When I got to Ramadi, that's when it really hit me that, you know, our story was not being told. We were in abhorrent conditions. Our soldiers were under attack every single night. We were clearing roadside bombs, and we lost a lot of guys killed and wounded. And I just didn't see the sort of coverage in the press that I thought really did justice to the sacrifices we were making.
What did you think was the biggest failing on the part of the reporters covering your unit?
The biggest failing on the ones covering my unit were that they weren't really around. We heard all the time that there were plenty of journalists around Baghdad, but they weren't making their way out to us. And when they did, I mean, they covered a lot of lame things like what the soldiers were getting for Christmas in their packages and soldiers playing soccer on base and things like that. There was a lot of stuff going on. We were in a Marine sector, and they were doing very, very intense combat operations the entire time, which just weren't given time in the news.
But when you were cheek by jowl with reporters, you actually liked them.
Absolutely. Like I said, it was very dangerous where we were, and the ones who made it out to our area were quite brave, in my opinion. And I talked to them a lot about the thoughts I'd had possibly going into journalism. They were very encouraging to me. They told me that my experience as an officer in combat would be an asset in telling the real story, and you know, I really took that to heart.
So you go to Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, which is probably the elite J school in the country. You get a couple of internships really in fascinating places. And then, miraculously enough, in this spiraling vortex of ruin that is the newspaper economy, you land a job at the Newark Star-Ledger. You spend some time there as a reporter, and then very soon you are assigned the military beat. I guess at least potentially offering the culmination of this long journey you've undertaken. And how long were you on the military beat before you get a telephone call from your mom?
It was about a week, I think. I didn't have long on it. I got to do one story. It was about this Marine recruiter in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, who was the top Marine recruiter in the U.S. And I put everything into it because I really wanted to impress my editor with my first story. And it actually went on and made page A1 of the paper.
So your mom calls and she says...
She says, Matt, I have something to tell you, and I'm just so sorry. She kept saying it over and over, and I said, Mom, what's the problem? Is someone hurt? And she finally just told me, Matt, a letter came in the mail from the Army, and it says you have to go back.
Now, before I move forward in the narrative, I want to say that at this point, you have now spent time with fellow journalism students and fellow journalists. What was your take on your now colleagues and their view of you and the war that you fought in?
What bothered me most was the stereotyping that I saw again and again in the press. If I didn't know any better, I probably would have thought that the Army and Marines were full of mostly poor, uneducated soldiers, immigrants in a lot of cases who just wanted to pay for college, but who instead wind up with PTSD. Every one of those types exists, but most of us are just normal men and women who had a calling and are quietly serving.
But when you were in school, and when some of your professors or classmates would start talking in ways that were demonizing or stereotypical, and you objected, what was their reaction?
For the most part, people were very curious about my background, and I was happy to indulge in all the questions they had about my experience and where I come from. But there were those few who definitely had an idea of what the military was and were completely against the war effort and made it known. You know, I did what I could to try to convey to them what the military was really all about, what the people who served in the military believed and thought. And, you know, I don't know if it ever got through, but I like to hope that it did somewhat.
Meanwhile, your West Point colleagues also took a rather dim view of your decision to become a journalist.
First off, I've gotten an overwhelmingly positive response from fellow soldiers and West Point friends who have read the essay. But yes, there was an incident that was really jarring. I went to a banquet being held by the New York chapter of the West Point Association of Graduates. You know, I kind of missed the old life a little. And so I thought it would be cool to reconnect with people that I shared similar experiences with. Anyway, when I told the guy who had organized the event that I was a newspaper reporter, he got real serious and said, "Press isn't welcome here." And I got other similar reactions that night. I just felt really out of place, and it was disappointing to me. I got called back to the Army the next week, but I don't think I would have gone to another function like that. I just didn't feel welcome. It made me really sad.
It kind of reminds me of the immigrant story, where you are neither of the country you hail from nor of the country where you have settled.
No, that's exactly right. Leaving the Army, I felt like a turncoat, and later in journalism circles, I felt sort of like an imposter. I asked myself all the time, you know, was I more loyal to my friends and leaders in the Army, or was I loyal to my editors and colleagues? I struggled with that for a long time.
So now you're back in uniform in Afghanistan, and you have this unique perspective of the mutual distrust between the military and the media, and you observe an Army practice which pulls you up short. In talking to our producer, you described a process by which the military, in investigating the reporters who are investigating them, come up with an analysis with pie charts and everything else to try to ascertain how negative or positive the reporting is likely to be. Is that really going on?
Yes, it is. The military is now commissioning private companies to research, profile, and make assessments about reporters' previous military coverage. They rate it using pie charts and graphs, as you said, and finish it off with a summary evaluation, which to me carries an almost Orwellian overtone. For example, we have a reporter on the ground right now, and his assessment reads like this. Given his neutral to positive sentiment typical in his narrative reporting, as well as the characterization of his media outlet, which is politically center-right, one may expect this reporter to produce coverage that is, at the least, neutral in sentiment and representative of the military point of view of events, if not neutral to positive. Now, the idea here is to figure out the best place to put them or prevent them from embedding at all. And in my opinion, this just counters the ideals that we who wear the uniform are expected to represent.
Finally, now you're reporting to us on the ground. How does the military feel about that, about your CJR piece, about this conversation?
I don't think I'm going to get in any trouble over this, but there are those officers who are a bit scared, I think, of what I'm going to write about my experience. So it's been interesting. I haven't made a lot of close friends, but the truth needs to be told about the relationship between the two professions.
All right, Matt. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Matt Mabe is a journalist and Army officer stationed in Gardez, Afghanistan. He and his girlfriend Molly Birnbaum write about what it's like for a couple to be separated by war on their blog hereandfar.blogspot.com. Coming up, are journalists who court death hardwired differently from the rest of us? This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. On Wednesday, current TV journalists Laura Ling and Yuna Lee stepped off a plane in Burbank, California. Just days prior, they'd been prisoners in North Korea, facing 12 years of hard labor in one of the country's infamous gulags. The details of their release are extraordinary. Apparently, the women were told they'd be freed if Bill Clinton agreed to meet with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il. They passed that message along to their families, who in turn told current TV co-founder Al Gore, who called his former boss, the meeting was arranged, and the rest is great TV.
I can't wait to see the reunion, Bill, between Yuna Lee and her little four-year-old daughter.
Can we have another shot of her? Can we get the camera over there?
Yeah, can you pan left there? Here she comes. She's bounding up.
Oh. Crisp, beautiful day here in Burbank. The white plane against the black mountains and the blue sky overhead. A beautiful welcome home for the two journalists.
Well, let's watch this unfold. There we see them exiting the plane right now, and there we see their family members, and we're hearing the cheers.
Their story has a happy ending, but for a lot of journalists who risk their lives for their reporting, that isn't the case. On the same day Ling and Lee landed in the United States, a trial began a world away in Russia, the second trial in the murder of Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya, who devoted herself to exposing human rights abuses by the Russian army in Chechnya. When we think of journalists in peril, many of us envision reporters like Ling and Lee, foreign correspondents in the wrong place at the wrong time. But according to investigative reporter Terry Gould, most of the time reporters who are murdered are living among their murderers. And in most of the cases, the perpetrators go unpunished. In his book Marked for Death, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places, Gould asks what would possess a person to put his or her life in danger to report a story. Gould profiled 7 slain reporters, including Politkovskaya, in 5 of the most dangerous countries for journalists: Colombia, the Philippines, Bangladesh, Iraq, and Russia. He conducted what he calls life investigations, interviewing journalists, loved ones, colleagues, and even the people who arranged the murders. He found that in all cases, these reporters knew they'd be killed if they pursued their investigations, but they continued anyway. As Gould explains, they shared a common psychology.
They were all imbued with this psychology of sacrifice. We can start with the first biography I tell in the book. His name is Guillermo Bravo Vega. His mother was murdered probably by his father, who had had her as a mistress, and who took him in the house and raised him as part of the upper-class Colombian society. When he was 22, 23, he was in a bar with some policemen, and he considered himself the right wing at the time. And there were some working men at a table, and they got into an argument. They said to him, "If you're so brave, man, shoot me." And he picked up a gun and he shot them. He was so mortified by that event in his life that he dedicated his entire life afterwards.
After getting out of prison.
Yeah. And he became a journalist, and he exposed the very system that had raised him and exposed the organized criminal elements in Colombia.
Guillermo not only knew he was doomed, but he actually kind of invited doom. Can you tell me the story of him leaving town and then how he behaved when he came back?
Yes, a sicario, a hired assassin, came to his house and warned him and told him to keep his doors locked and then flee town. And he told his friends, "This time they'll get me." And he did flee town, and he stayed away 2 weeks. Even though he was certain if he returned to town, he'd be murdered, he came back to town. And he was working on a documentary about murdered journalists and murdered human rights workers who were murdered by paramilitaries in the right wing. He was very much in despair towards the end of his life. He said that there was no way for him to succeed in stopping the systematic corruption in Colombia. And he knew that the story of his death would probably promote some little change, and he actually welcomed death. So he did something very unusual when he came home. Even though he should have kept his doors locked, he would leave his door open every night. And finally, the murderers drove up on a motorcycle and walked through the door and killed him.
Now, you have described Guillermo as obsessive, and this story bespeaks some sort of combination of recklessness and resignation, but not unique to him and his story.
I've told 7 stories of 7 different journalists, and I found 2 commonalities. The first was that they had each had a transformational event in their lives. Something had happened to them, or they had done something to others that through guilt or revelation or grief convinced them that the powerful had to be prevented from oppressing the weak at all costs. The second commonality was that they didn't arrive from somewhere else. In other words, these were not foreign correspondents coming in, staying in secure hotels. These were local journalists who went home to bungalows where all that stood between them and murder was a quarter-inch plywood door. Yet they targeted the most malevolent forces in their countries. All these countries were run according to the principle of organized crime.
Another dangerous place for investigative journalism is Russia, perhaps most infamously in 2006 with the murder in her own apartment building of journalist Anna Politkovskaya. Please tell me her story.
Anna was born to a Soviet elite family in the 1950s, and her parents were United Nations diplomats, and she became a journalist. The thing that she was concentrating on as a journalist was profiles of the elite, and the artistic set within her own milieu. During the first Chechen War, in 1996, she phoned a refugee center, and she said that she wanted to do a story about big-eyed Chechen children going to school. The person that ran the refugee center said to her, "Well, I must tell you, Anna, that they can't go to school. Come down here and see what's going on here." Anna was a beautiful woman, almost like a model. Good clothes and good looks were very important to her. So she swooshes into this refugee center, opens the door, and there, lining the walls, are parents that had just lost children, children that had just lost parents, people wailing, people wounded. And she stopped up short and she said, what have I been doing with my life? And that shame that she felt for herself was compounded by the shame that she felt for the vast majority of Russians who did not care what was going on in Chechnya. And when the Second Chechen War broke out, she reported on the atrocities being committed by Russian generals and their Chechen allies, rapes and murders, and named the names of the perpetrators, even as she moved amongst them in very dangerous territory.
This story has a tragic personal twist for you. What happened?
I was going to use her as a source about two other Russian journalists who had given their lives for stories. I landed in Moscow on October 7th. I phoned the Committee to Protect Journalists to let them know I'd arrived and I would be speaking with Politkovskaya, and they told me, you're too late. She was just killed today outside the elevator in her apartment house.
I certainly do not wish to dishonor the memories of heroes, but I have to ask you, in sort of issuing their own death sentences, they obviously affected the lives of their loved ones as well, who perhaps would have been less willing to see them die for the stories that they were working on. Does that not cross any kind of line?
In all cases, they had families. In all cases, their families wanted them to stop their journalism. In all cases, they looked above the heads of their own families and looked at the families of other people around them and said, these people are like my own family. And if it was done to me, I hope somebody would come forward and try and save my family.
Let me just ask you one last thing. The stories in your book are all about reporters taking on the continuing criminal enterprises that were their governments, you know, mafia as state enterprises, in effect. You, in your own personal life, have some experience living in that kind of culture. Can you tell me about it?
I grew up in a lousy neighborhood in Brooklyn, and my grandfather was a member of organized crime. He was thrown off a roof when I was 4 years old. There was a bookie joint below our apartment house, and we would see the police come in and go out all the time. There was a bar next door where the prostitutes and the police again would come in and go out drunk as skunks. I got used to the idea that some people had impunity. And I also saw that where officials were allowed to break the law, ordinary people eventually joined the law-breaking. And when you put that on a worldwide scale, eventually it gets to the point where it's okay to murder people. When I turned to journalism, turned to organized crime, I realized that same ethic reigned in all these countries where the most journalists are being killed. They have ethics that actually have names. In Colombia, it's called regalame, give it to me for nothing. In Russia, it's called krisha, means roof. You buy protection, influence, and impunity. All these seven journalists refused to participate, and they exposed that systemic principle of organized crime, and they died in the process doing it.
Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Terry Gould is a reporter and author of Marked for Death, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places. It will be published by Counterpoint Press in September. The titles of some of our most beloved books have a story of their own to tell. Take Joseph Heller's classic Catch-22. The phrase has come to mean an impossible bind. In the book, which is about flying bombing runs over Europe during the Second World War, the impossible bind is this. If a pilot is crazy, he can be grounded. But he can only be grounded if he asks to be grounded. But if he asks to be grounded, he's showing a concern for his own safety. So, therefore, he's sane. So he can't get out whether he's crazy or not. That's the Catch-22. But as author and book title expert Gary Dexter explains, it almost wasn't.
As Heller was writing it, he thought of it all the time as Catch-18. right at the point of publication, Leon Uris, the blockbuster novelist, wrote a book called Mila 18. And it was felt that Heller should be the one to blink and change his title since he was the first-time novelist. So he and his publishers, they went through a long process of numerical agonizing where they went through a whole series of different integers. 11 was considered, 14 was considered. Finally, they got to 22. And this seems now to reflect the themes of the book in a way that Catch 18, Catch 14 could never have done, because in the book, everything is doubled. The hero, Yusarian, he bombs
Ferrara. The number of missions he has to fly continues to escalate.
Exactly, yeah.
It also has a kind of cadence advantage. I mean, Catch 22 rolls off the tongue and a lot better, it seems to me, than Catch 18 would. But maybe that's just because we've become accustomed to Catch 22.
It's very difficult to know, isn't it? Joseph Heller was apparently absolutely distraught that he had to change his number. It took him 2 weeks to find another one.
I guess just adding four wouldn't have done the trick.
No.
Now, there are some famous titles that live forever in our hearts and minds that you believe could have been titled better, like Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland.
The book was originally entitled Alice's Adventures Underground. This was the first copy of the book that Lewis Carroll hand-wrote and hand-illustrated himself. He thought that people reading it might be confused. They might think the book was something to do with mining. So he wrote to a friend and asked for some title suggestions. His friend came up with Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. I feel that Alice's Adventures Underground is easily a better title, because Wonderland seems, in comparison, a very saccharine title, I think, and it's not a saccharine book.
There's another famous book which you also believe is mistitled, as a matter of fact, and that is Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury's futuristic science fiction classic.
Well, of course, Fahrenheit 451 is supposedly the temperature at which paper spontaneously catches fire and burns. And the novel is about a society in which reading is illegal and which firemen are paid to impound books and burn them. Bradbury knew he wanted to use this temperature. Now, this doesn't quite explain the title, because if Bradbury had got it from contemporary sources, he would have been reading something similar to something that I consulted, which is called the Handbook of Physical Testing of Paper. It says, the ignition temperature of paper is about 450 degrees C, but is somewhat dependent on the paper quality. But this is Celsius, so could Bradbury have mistook C for F? Because if you translate that into Fahrenheit terms, it turns out to about 843 degrees. So perhaps the book should have been Fahrenheit 843, the temperature at which certain kinds of book paper catch fire and burn. You know, possibly not as catchy. But...
No, it really doesn't trip off the tongue, does it? So, okay, you are, I suppose, one of the world's experts on book titles. It just so happens, my friend, that Brooke Gladstone, my co-host, is on leave right now writing her book, which she has tentatively titled The Influencing Machine. And I am, even as we speak, releasing my latest book titled The Chaos Scenario. What do you think?
Wow, that's very interesting. Well, in your book title, you've got two opposed nouns. And this is a strategy that you see in Robert Ludlum's books, isn't
yes,
it?
Exactly.
Born Identity, the Bancroft Strategy. This has worked very well for Robert.
My whole strategy is to bank on consumer confusion.
Yeah.
I want people to think they're buying a thriller instead of a disquisition on the future of media.
All right. Let's hope they're pleasantly surprised.
Now, what about a piece of graphic nonfiction titled The Influencing Machine? How does that grab you?
Yeah, graphic nonfiction. Is this actually in pictures?
Yes, it certainly is.
The Influencing Machine, yeah. I like it very much. It has a slight sort of 60s feel to it. It's like those titles which are warning about dire consequences of population explosions and things like that.
Any numbers that you would think we should throw in there? Influencing a Machine 322. What do you think?
Yeah. Sort of room 101 or something like that. Yeah, I could do well.
You're being polite, but you don't seem like you're rushing to get to the bookstore.
I would definitely buy that book. I'm going to put my order in now. As soon as I get off the radio, I'm going to go and put it in.
Well, bless your heart. That's one. Gary, thank you so much.
Okay, my pleasure.
Gary Dexter is the author of Why Not Catch 21, the stories behind the titles, and his new novel, The Oxford Despoiler.
One wonders if War and Peace would have been as highly acclaimed as it was had it been published under its original title, War, What Is It Good For? Yeah, Mr. Lippman, it was his mistress who insisted that he call it War and Peace. War, What Is It Good For? Absolutely nothing. Say it again.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Sarah Fidelibus and Kasia Glodke, and edited this week by our most senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be stopping in next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by Live from Lincoln Center, broadcasting Joshua Bell and the Mostly Mozart Festival Orchestra in Avery Fisher Hall on Wednesday, August 12th at 8. Broadcast times are available through local PBS listings. On the Media is also supported by the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.